Hey everyone, just a special announcement about today's episode. Recently, we launched our new Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. Theology on Tap is a lecture series that we've been running at the camphouse for 5 years now. And this fall, we began publishing the lectures through the new podcast. And I wanted to share one of those with you here on the Camphouse podcast. So during Startup Week this year, we invited Dr. Greg Thompson for a special Theology on Tap on innovation. And I think it's a very important lecture for our city as we continue to build around the innovation and entrepreneurship economy. Now, this being Theology on Tap, his talk will certainly have a theological bend in it, but I honestly believe it's something that everyone will benefit from. And if you're not someone of faith, we'll at the very least be encouraged by the fact that there are Christians out there with the sort of perspective on innovation and community that Dr. Greg Thompson shares here. Now, the intro and the music for this episode is all from our Theology on Tap podcast. And in the show notes to this episode, I'll provide links where you can check out other TOT episodes, as well as a couple links to Dr. Greg Thompson's work. So I hope you all enjoy the episode and have a great Thanksgiving.
Welcome to the Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. In each episode, we feature a different lecture given by a writer, scholar, or public intellectual. Each of these talks explores the intersection between theology and culture, and how theology can help better guide us toward the common good of society. These talks are given live at our monthly Theology on Tap events at the Camphouse in Chattanooga, Tennessee. For more information and to find out when our next live event is, check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheologyOnTapChattanooga. Now, here is this week's episode. We hope you enjoy listening.
Well, this evening, I'm excited to introduce Dr. Greg Thompson. He is the Director of Research and Strategy at Claiborne Reborn, a historic civil rights site in Memphis, Tennessee. He's also a senior advisor for the TomTom Founders Festival in Charlottesville, Virginia. Before joining Claiborne and TomTom, Greg served as the CEO of Thriving Cities Group, a civic design firm based in Charlottesville, and as the Executive Director of New City Commons, a consulting team that supports faith-based communities in the work of serving their cities. Greg is also active in national conversations surrounding race and equity in America and holds a PhD from the University of Virginia, where he wrote his dissertation on Martin Luther King Jr. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. Greg Thompson.
Hey, everybody. So this is Innovation Week. And I want to just begin by acknowledging how amazing that is and how cool it is that cities all over the United States are hosting innovation weeks, innovation festivals, innovation gatherings, where men and women who are in their cities are seeking to take responsibility for the well-being of their cities through economic innovation, innovation of all kinds. It's an extraordinary thing. And it's a privilege for me to be here at this one. I also want to comment on how weird it is that there are things called innovation weeks. And I don't want us to forget that either, because while innovation, this drive to do something new is a feature of our age, it really was not always the case. Because see, there are ages when innovation, the idea of innovation is sort of the provenance of scientists or technological elites. But most people simply inhabit the structures they receive. They're not thinking about innovating. So for example, neither my grandparents nor my parents ever went to an innovation conference, right? Like they never would have, it would not have occurred to them to do that. But all of us here, even if you're not folks who would describe yourself as innovators, it feels kind of normal, sort of interesting. We're going to go to an innovation week and we're going to go to an innovation event. Why are we here? Like, why do these things happen? Why am I a senior advisor for the one in Charlottesville? Why am I here visiting the one in Chattanooga? Why am I helping to start one in Memphis? Because we know that something is happening, something weird is happening in the world. We can intuit that we live in one of those moments in history when something new is happening around us, to us, and even through us. We know this, and you're not wrong about this. Something is, in fact, happening. But what is it? Well, a lot of things are happening, and I want you to hear this. Okay, the globalization of markets, that's a big deal. The pluralization of communities, the acceleration of technologies, all of these things are happening. You know about this. And they're conspiring to create this new world in which the old market forms, the customer services, the technological tools for navigating these experiences of day-to-day life, they're no longer adequate. We know this. Like, we actually have to rebuild the way that our economy and the way our structures work. They don't work anymore. And so it's been born in this incredible moment in our own time, and I think this is completely insane. There's this new age of innovation, and you all are familiar with it, and it feels normal to you in a way that it probably did not feel normal to you 10 years ago. I don't know how many of you were like scoping out innovation festivals even a decade ago, but like here we are. But look, while the existence of innovation, this wonderful tumultuous churn that's happening all over the global economy, the existence of it is really beyond any sort of serious question. Really, really important questions about innovation still remain. And among those, I think that the most important question, the question that we have yet to really collectively answer in a way that actually shapes the way we imagine business, the way that we invest in business, is innovation to what end? Innovation to what end? What exactly is it that we, through all of our incredible innovative labors, are trying to achieve? What should we be trying to achieve? What, if anything, is it that animates, that disciplines, that finally evaluates the meaning of the innovation that we have? I think that's a really hard question. And I don't think that there are any clear answers to that. And that's another feature of our age. We're all breathless about innovation, but we're a little inarticulate about the end of innovation, like why we're doing this. Now, in my own personal experience, as somebody who has been around the innovation space some and who lives and works and goes to places where I meet innovators, which I love, I basically, when I ask people, why are we doing this innovation, I think there are two answers. I see if these sort of resonate with you. The first is that the end of innovation is the advancement of knowledge. Like, we want to experiment, we want to grow the ideas that we have. That is to say that the energy and the discipline, the evaluation of innovation, it's really about the ideas. It's really about taking an idea, to use a business language, from idea, from concept to scale, about growing this knowledge. And so you can see if you're in, especially in tech innovation, or if you're in innovation in the sciences, or even in market innovation, where people are trying to open up new markets. It's about the ideas. And so the idea is that the thrill, the end of innovation is basically this thrill of thinking of something cool and then making it happen. And a lot of you feel like this. You know how amazing it is to think of something cool and then see it grow in the world. Now, the other idea that I hear, okay, this is why we're doing this. It's not just about ideas, it's about the market. What we want to do is we don't just have like intellectual innovations, we want to have market success. That is to say, we want to attain the embrace and valuation of the market. So the idea is that you find and create an opening in the market, then you own that market space, and then you continue to own it or you sell it. And that is part of the discourse of innovation everywhere. And so if you go to innovation conferences, people say, well, we're always at the point where we can exit. We know what that means. We built something cool, and now we're ready to exit, and that is success in the innovation world. All over the place. And you see this everywhere. I know that you see it. Now, I want to say that as somebody who is interested in innovation, I think both of those are really important. We have to have ideas that we can take from concept to scale, and we have to have markets. We have to have places where there are these market inefficiencies that we can get inside and disrupt. Like, you can't have innovation without those things. But I also find them both kind of unsatisfactory. I find them unsatisfactory. Neither seems sufficient to really answer the question of why we're doing what we're doing. Why in the world are we at an innovation conference right now? Now, in order to discover the end of innovation, I had to turn outside of the innovation discourse itself and go elsewhere, and where I went was to the Christian faith. I don't know that everybody here is a Christian. I am a Christian. I'm not a very good Christian, but I am a Christian, and I've spent the past 25 years of my life trying to order my life around the truths of the Christian faith and the practices of the Christian faith. That's been what my life has been. And so the Christian faith for me is really where everything begins. But even so, I have to say that looking to Christianity for the end of innovation was not intuitive. Like, what does the vision of an ancient, largely nomadic, agrarian faith have to say about late modern capitalism and the markets that are opening up? It's not obvious. I mean, we can say, well, it's about shalom. Okay, well, what does that mean? So I had to go and look and see and try to understand this. And as it turns out, the Christian faith says a great deal about innovation. And here's why. First, because Christianity, for all of its antiquity, is obsessed with newness. It is obsessed with newness. And think about God that is revealed in Christianity. He begins with the new word from his mouth yields a new creation. He creates a new people who then inhabit a new land. And in time, a new presence comes to dwell with us who gives a new hope and meaning to the world that creates this new Israel that is then endowed with a new power by the Spirit and that promises, this God promises through us to, what does he say in Revelation 21, for those of you who know, like, I'm making all things new. It was really hard to avoid the language of newness. It tells a story of a God who is interested in this generative power, who's laboring to make things new. And this commitment to newness, which, as you know, or in Latin, nova, that's the heart of innovation, right? This idea of this divine making of things new. And this means that from a Christian perspective, to understand the end of innovation, what it means to be innovative, we actually have to look at God and what God is doing in the world, this one who makes all things new. But it's not just about God, it's also about the church. I don't know how much of you have studied, many of you have studied church history and how much, but man, when I started asking questions about innovation with respect to church history, it basically blew my mind. Like, if you think about the ancient church, okay, our brothers and sisters, for those of you who are in the faith here, they came up with new forms of care for the sick, new forms of burying the dead. These are innovations that came out of the Christian community in the Middle Ages. There are new forms of music, new forms of education, of architecture, new structures of governance, new actual economic structures are created. New modes of currency are created out of the Christian church. Or moved to the Reformation. There are definitely new forms of church life, new forms of music, new forms of the visual arts, new models of city governance that continue to shape the way life in the West exists. In the Enlightenment, there were new political models that were emerging, new scientific ventures, new medical technologies. And in the modern age, you have Christian communities giving birth to new forms of agricultural production, new market initiatives, new ways of harnessing alternative energies. There's new visions of retail, hospitality, medicine, investment. It's unbelievable how just in the Christian space, how many people are doing amazing, cool, new things. And as I turned to Christianity, what I saw then was this is not accidental. This is actually essential to who the Christian church is because we have a God who makes things new. We have become a people who make things new, and it just like oozes out of us. And if there's something that needs to be made new, well, church folk are just going to figure it out. That's what happens. It's happened all throughout history. And I actually think that that is an incredible thing, that innovation, the sense of making things new, is at the heart of the Christian vocation in the world. And I just didn't know that before. I thought, okay, Christian faith, maybe some faith and work stuff, and then there's this like hipster innovation space over here, and I don't know how these things fit together, right? But then I saw, no, they're actually integral because we believe in a God who makes things new, and we're a people who labor to that end in spite of ourselves. And as I looked at Christian story, and I found myself asking this question, what is it that drives all of this madness? All of this drive to innovation, what is it that animates and disciplines and finally evaluates the Christian urge to make something new? And do you know what it is? Do you know what the end of innovation is? It is love. It is love. In Christianity, the energy of innovation, the drive towards the new, is love. And so it was here at the beginning, that is to say in Christianity, that I learned the end of innovation, that it is not fundamentally about the advancement of knowledge, nor about the embrace of the market, but the love of neighbor. Innovation is, as all things Christian are, about love. So what does it mean? What does it mean for us to stand in an innovation week and say, innovation in Chattanooga is about love? In short, and this is important, this is probably the most important thing I'll say, it means that the end of innovation, the yearning that actually animates and disciplines and judges our innovative labors, is the creation of a world in which our neighbors can thrive. That is the energy of innovation, the creation of a world in which our neighbors can thrive. It means an insistence that the knowledge that we advance and the markets that we disrupt or create have as their end the well-being of those around us. That is the end of innovation. And I think that actually, where I didn't believe that the Christian church had a lot to say in this moment, this sort of renaissance of innovation, I actually think that the Christian church has something extraordinarily important and critical to say and distinctive to say about this birth of innovation, and it is that innovation has always been and must always be about love, and that is the unique contribution that we can make when we talk about innovation in our cities. But what does this require of us? Like, if we're going to be innovation folk, people who are innovators, what does it mean for us to carry out the innovations of love? I want to say four things, okay? They're brief, I promise. So one person just looked like they're going to have a stroke when I said four things. So I'm going to say four. Let's pull it in. The first is that we're going to have to retrain ourselves. We're going to have to retrain ourselves. Some of us are driven by this exciting energy of innovation, and I think that's important. But we're going to have to retrain ourselves to see that innovation is about love. Now, if you're here and you've been in the innovation space, you can think, gosh, this notion that innovation is about love, it sounds a little bit naive. It sounds a little bit idealist. And I understand this, but I also want you to understand that that perspective is mistaken. And it's not only mistaken, it's actually fairly conventional. To say that innovation can't be about love is like an old way of thinking. In other words, it's anti-innovation, because love is the innovation. And it's not only conventional to say, well, love can't really be influencing our innovations. It's harmful because, and this is what happens, I see it everywhere and so do you, it allows the enormous amount of intellectual, financial, relational, and technological capital at our disposal to be distributed without ever having to be encumbered by the needs of our neighbors. If we do not understand that innovation is fundamentally about love of neighbor, we will do what we in fact do, which is to distribute the enormous amount of intellectual, financial, relational, and technological capital in a way that is never encumbered by the needs of our neighbors. And no one will think that we are wrong because we are advancing ideas and achieving market success, but we are not affecting love. And so I think we have to refocus, retrain ourselves on the work of love's innovation. So what would that mean? If you're an innovator, let me speak to you first, and I'm going to talk to investors. It means that what you are thinking about, it means that your innovations are not fundamentally about your ideas, but about your neighbor's needs. It's to say, not like, what cool idea do I have that I want to take to scale? It is, what need does my neighbor have that I need to figure out how to solve? That is a very different way of thinking about innovation. And I think as innovators, we need to encourage one another and train one another to think first in terms of the needs that we are meeting in the world, not just the market opportunities that we're exploiting in the world. Now, and it means also that if you're an investor, you need to begin to give innovators the opportunity to work in a way that is not just about short-term yield, but about long-term civic impact. You need to develop a more patient way of investing your capital so that you can give innovators the space and the time to see love come to fruition. Because a lot of innovation is squashed not by innovators who don't care, but by investors who don't see. And so if you're in this space and you're an investor, part of the work is to say, we are going to invest in the works of love, and we're going to be deliberate about that. So that's the first thing. We have to retrain ourselves. Secondly, we have to re-engage our neighbors. We have to re-engage our neighbors. Having to turn from ourselves and said, okay, gosh, I want to let go of the merely provincial notion that innovation is about my genius or about a market opportunity, we have to now turn to our neighbors and begin to ask what they need. And this is an inescapably neighborly and civic and urban question. And this is deeply important, okay? Because I think I see a lot of people, and I myself have been one of those people, who really care about innovation, who really want to see things that can impact their neighbors. But if I were to say, what does Chattanooga need? Or what does Charlottesville need? Or what does Memphis need? We don't really know. We can have anecdotes, but we don't know how to talk about that. And I think that this is really important that we have to really understand collectively the deep needs of the community, both now and in the age to come, in the years to come, and to begin to devote our innovations towards that. Does this make sense? So innovate out of a deep knowledge, not an intuition of what you think is cool or what I think is interesting, but out of what is actually needed, and let other people tell us that. Let our neighbors tell us what they need. Let the city corroborate that this is in fact the need. Because I have to say that we need to re-engage our cities and devote ourselves to understanding how they work, what our cities face, what assets it has, what deficits it has, and what can be done. And so this returning to our neighbors, I think, and I don't mean just in terms of sentiment, but in terms of like real knowledge. And this was something I had to learn. I was a pastor for 15 years. And I don't think it was probably until like year 12 that I ever realized that I needed to ask leaders in my city what they needed. I just thought I knew what they needed. because I like had the creation, fall, redemption, consummation, shalom thing. That's like, check that box, man. That about covers it. But I had to say, no, specifically, what do you need? Oh, you need an incubator for minority women to have businesses. Oh, you need a different form of public transit. Oh, you need these classes to be offered at a different time. I just didn't know. And so I want to urge that if you're thinking about this innovation, let it be always in dialogue with the needs of the neighbor. So retraining ourselves, returning to our neighbor. Here's the third thing, and this is a part of what we're doing here, and this is reprioritizing formation. Reprioritizing formation, meaning the formation of innovators. See, city renewal is not simply a technical act, it is a moral act. The renewal of cities and the renewal of communities is not simply a technical act that requires certain technical skills. It is a moral act that requires certain kinds of people. And this means that healthy cities require strong networks of well-formed leaders in innovation who are committed to the well-being of their neighbors. And I know that this is part of what's happening with the Faith and Work Initiative. It's part of what's happening with Theology on Tap. It's this idea that we need to create an entire network, an overlapping dense network of men and women working in multiple sectors who are formed in virtue. And I've spent a lot of time around business schools. I've spent a lot of time around incubators, around business accelerators. And I can say that there are very few of them that prioritize the virtue and the integrity of the leader. It's about finding the genius who can discern the market need and then go develop a sort of system for disrupting it. And part of what has to make us different in the Christian church is we have to reprioritize the formation of virtuous men and women who are moving into this innovation space. And I think that's an incredibly, incredibly, incredibly important thing to do. And I want to say this personally. There was a point in my life when I realized my gifts are outstripping my virtue. And that is a very dangerous place to be. And we have lots of people that are like that. So please, as we're thinking about creating an innovation district and integration communities, we have to think about those through the reprioritization of formation. And so that means that we need to begin to train men and women to think about, to give them the kind of civic imagination and the intellectual clarity, the moral disposition, the practical skills that are going to be required for building thriving cities. So I want to urge the reprioritization of formation. And here's the last thing. I think finally we need to redefine innovation. The Christian church needs to redefine innovation in this contemporary age, that we need to change the meaning and the expectations of what we mean when we say innovation. I've already said this. We live in this unparalleled moment of global innovation. It's nascent. It's a little bit like the Wild West, right? It's like kind of fun to be in the innovation space. It's exciting, and you want to be a chief strategist or an innovator of some kind. It's like super cool. But we don't know what we mean yet. And what that means to me is that we have an opportunity to shape the identity of a market, to shape the identity of a discipline. The Christian church has done this before. We can do this now. And we have to actually change the larger cultural narrative and say, no, sorry, that's not innovation. That's just taking an idea from concept to scale. Or that's not actually innovation. That's just disrupting a market. Lots of people do that. Innovation means the cultivation and instantiation of love in the institutions of a city. We want to see love take flesh in the streets of our world. Now, how do we do this? How can we actually change the way people think about innovation? And before I answer that question, we actually can, industries can be transformed. So for example, 15 years ago, if you're in New York City and you wanted a ride somewhere, what did you do? You walked out on the street and you did this, right? If you want to ride in New York City, what do you do now? You do this. Uber totally changed the way we thought of an entire industry. It just redefined it. And I actually think that the innovation space is new enough in its broad and popular notion that it can be changed. There's still room to give it shape. And I want to urge you to do that. First, by incentivizing it. If you are an investor here, if you are a person who has the means to invest, you need to incentivize ventures that are ordered towards love of neighbor. You need to insist on that. You need to incentivize it and give people the opportunity to build this, because there are lots of places, lots of investors are not doing that. How are people going to risk love if they can't have capital investments that actually allow them to do so? So we have to create a philanthropic or an investment or a social impact investment or a venture or an equity, private equity community that says we're going to actually prioritize love of neighbor in these investments, and we're going to be very disciplined about that. We're going to know what we mean. Second, not just incentivizing it, we also need to do it. Some of us have the capacity for innovation right now, and it'd be worth you saying, what I'm going to do in this next venture I have, and I'm going to try to identify a need in the city, I'm going to try to figure out a way that I can both take an idea from concept to scale and disrupt a market, that I can make this thing work, and I want to demonstrate this as a case study that love-based innovation works. We have to just do it. And so incentivizing it, doing it. Third, and this is important, if you're here and you're not an investor or an innovator, but you're a consumer, here's what you should do. You should expect it. You should expect that the men and women who are leading businesses and doing innovation in this community are doing so for the good of their neighbors. That should be a market expectation. And say, yeah, we would love to use your goods. We would love to participate in your business. We'd love to buy your service. But you have to demonstrate to us that you are caring for people in our city. And I think that is the most, maybe the most powerful engine for transforming the kind of discipline of innovation is consumers that expect it to be about the well-being of others. That is extraordinarily powerful, and I want to urge you to do that. And then the last thing I'll say is not just by incentivizing it, doing it, and expecting it, but also by broadcasting it. One of the things that I like about the Theology on Tap podcast and things like that is there are amazing things happening in this city. There are amazing things happening in lots of cities. Somebody needs to be telling those stories over and over and over. Business schools need to be writing case studies on those kinds of businesses. We have to shape people's imaginations by telling them, here is a more beautiful way. Here is a more beautiful way. I think that people around the country, I work in a lot of different cities, but people around the country are looking to innovators. They're looking to this innovator class, to people like you. And I actually think that if you self-consciously embrace the calling to re-narrate the meaning of innovation and say, in Chattanooga, innovation is about love of neighbor. It's about the common good. Then you have the ability not only to change your city, but to actually change other cities that are looking at you. Because lots of people are looking at you. And when I travel around and we're talking about Memphis, Knoxville, Nashville, Chattanooga, people know what you're doing in the city. People know about this Innovation Week. People know about the Innovation District. They know about the very cool things that are happening. And I think this is an opportunity to bear witness to something else. So how do we do this? I think we have to retrain ourselves. We have to re-engage our neighbors. We have to reprioritize formation, and we have to kind of re-narrate innovation, broadly speaking. What will happen if we do this in Chattanooga or in Charlottesville or Memphis or whatever? I don't know. The whole point of innovation is that it's new, right? I don't know exactly what it will look like. It's by definition an unknown path, but here's what I think could happen. You could, as a woman, as a man, participating in this innovation, more deeply participate in the innovations of God's love in this world. I actually see this as a participation in the vocation of the second Adam, who himself is making things new. It's an extraordinary act of communion to innovate with and through him for the sake of others. So that's like the mystical horizon of innovation, and I think it's super important. But not only that, we would not just move more deeply into the life of God, we would move more deeply into the lives of our neighbors. And I want to say this before I close. One of the things that concerns me about every innovation district, conference, room, seminar I'm in is who's not in the room. We have the opportunity and the temptation to create a very cool, interesting economic ecosystem for ourselves. For ourselves. And that is exactly what will happen. Unless there is a group of people, a group of men and women that say, this is not just about my life with God. It's not just about my ideas. It's not just about me disrupting a market. It is about the neighbor. And it is about me finding the neighbors in this community and enabling their innovations, coming alongside them. Because it is 100% certain that the new wave of innovation is going to reinforce the historic structures of the American economy. Unless we are deliberate about disrupting it. And so what we have the opportunity to do is not just dwell more intimately with God, but actually, and I personally, as a civil rights scholar, I'm going to say this, I think this actually is the future of the economic future of the civil rights movement. I think the civil rights movement has moved from a national movement where there's a National Civil Rights Act and the National Voting Act. It is going to be about local economies becoming inclusive and equitable. That is how this goes forward. Remember Martin Luther King, I'm on a rant right now, but remember when Martin Luther King at the end of his life in 1968, you know what he was doing? He had turned from merely racial activism to fundamentally economic interventions. That is what he believed. The last thing he was doing when he was at the sanitation workers' strike in Memphis was working on the Poor People's Campaign. The future of the American civil rights movement is not fundamentally, in my judgment, political or legislative. It is economic. And so please understand that you have the opportunity not just to dwell more deeply with God, but to actually do some of this stuff that King and other people were not yet able to do. This is about creating these inclusive economies and supporting people who don't look like you that are doing it. And I think this is incredibly important. And when we do this, I think that might be the actual interesting story. Not that we had an idea that we took from concept to scale, not that we saw a market inefficiency that we intervened in and disrupted and made more productive, but that we actually took up the responsibility, our own little selves and our own little cities, and made this country economically new. I think it's incredibly powerful, and I want to commend that work to you and commend you for taking it up. And I think we're going to have some questions, so thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Theology on Tap Chattanooga podcast. To connect with us and learn about our next live events, like our Facebook page at facebook.com/TheologyOnTapChattanooga. You can also support TOT in two ways. First, leave us a rating and a review wherever you get your podcast from. And second, consider being a patron of Theology on Tap with a small monthly donation on patreon.com. And you can learn more about that at patreon.com/TheologyOnTap.